Are you ready for the expert? It's Lieutenant Colonel Daniel L. Davis, the host of Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and always a very popular guest of ours. Lieutenant Colonel, thank you very much for joining us. Let me, if I may, start with a political question, which I know you're interested in, but is it outside of the immediate area of your expertise, namely this extraordinary development in the J6 insurrection story. It seems to me that the American deep state has been caught red-handed for their attempt to drive a stake through the heart of Trump and his movement, and they've been caught out. Is that how it looks to you?
Well, it's a messy situation here. There is definitely lots of information. We've actually been having this for almost from the beginning, that there were folks inside the FBI and other agencies that were actually involved with this, not just that they were trying to find out what was happening, but they were participating and helping to gin the crowd up. There was also some blame to go around for the folks that participated in it, and for some of the way the thing was ginned up on the presidential, on the Trump side, etc. There's no empty enemy, or I'm sorry, there's no hands here that are clean. But just the problem is that you have all kinds of dirty hands in all over the place. And when you have folks that are is supposed to be in law enforcement actually participating in any level at all inside of what was going on, then they try to keep that a secret. That's not good for democracy, and it definitely isn't good for what happened on January 6th, which is a shame for our country all across the board.
Trump would be a fool to leave it unpunished, though, if this person that's been named by the Blaze and is now Thomas Massie, has named her and put up her picture, Congressman Thomas Massie. If this woman did lay a pipe bomb, and if she was a Capitol Police woman at the time, and if she is now a CIA operative, well, that's pretty serious, isn't it, Colonel?
Oh, without question. I am 100%, with no caveats, for the rule of law. Anyone who violates the rule of law should be held accountable. It should be literally blind. I mean, like it's supposed to be, you know, the lady justice with the blindfold on. That's how it's supposed to be. And no one should be above the law at all. Not anybody in the Democratic Party, not anybody in the Republican Party. In the case to where you do have different echelons of legality and, well, these people did something wrong, but I'm in power, so we'll punish them, but leave all these other ones unpunished, that's a bad situation. But when you have something that's pretty clear like this, and again, all I can say about it is what the evidence is showing so far, by all means, give them their day in court, but give them their day in court. Let's make sure that we actually get that, so that if the evidence confirms and an investigation can show that there was guilt, then there needs to be some accountability and punishment.
But nobody ever seems to get their day in court. The Epstein clients are very far from court. The people that rigged the 2020 election or are accused of doing so, none of them have been charged. It seems that Trump's pledge to drain the swamp was an empty pledge, either because they've got too much on him or because he's now a part of them. But for whatever reason, not many people are now all that convinced that a day in court's going to happen.
Well, that's the case. And we have, again, a conflation of some things where some people just make these ad nauseum accusations against people that they did this or that wrong. And the reason they haven't been brought to court is because there isn't actual evidence of it. The bigger concern is the ones where there is actual evidence of wrongdoing and we don't get them brought to court, because they're a friend of somebody that's in power. I mean, there was all kinds of folks during the Biden administration that were not held to account or even brought up on charges because they were friendly with the Democratic Party. So they were not going to even be charged. And now then we have a similar situation with the Republican side, and that nobody who even might have done something wrong on the Republican side will even be considered to be charged with anything. But then we also have this odd situation to where even some that are not friendly to the Republican side are also not being charged. Some of my really strong Republican friends are just beside themselves with a lot of cases where, I can't remember the guy's name right offhand. The one that used to be the DNI under Obama, and then Joe Biden, and you know, he did all kinds of things with this situation where they're trying to pin Russiagate on Trump, etc., and they used the Steele dossier that everybody knew was false. He knew was false. We now have Tulsi Gabbard has released classified information that shows that he knew that, Clapper, for example, and Dannon, and yet nothing has happened. So the question is, well, then why did we release this classified information that shows that they knew that that was fraudulent, and yet they pursued it anyway for intelligence, and yet nothing's happened? And that's a question I've gotten, and I don't have an answer for it.
No, but it's an appalling situation. It's the conduct of a banana republic, if you don't mind me saying so, where justice depends on...
I'm embarrassed that you have to say it, but I'm more embarrassed that it's true. I mean, it's true.
Yeah. Well, let's turn, if we may, to more warlike matters, Lieutenant Colonel, because your expertise is always really helpful to us. Pokrovsk has fallen. Kupiansk is partially occupied and will likely fall in the next couple of days. The Russian forces are on a roll, aren't they? And yet the money is still flowing from the European Union. The problem is, as Donald Trump just said, we're making money off the Iraq war because the European countries are buying our weapons. You're familiar with the phrase, don't throw good money after bad, don't reinforce failure. It's about time this war came to an end, isn't it?
Oh, gosh, Georgia, it's just, it's emphatically true. And just, I mean, I got to say, it drives me crazy when I see this, when you see, oh, okay, Pokrovsk is now effectively gone. You have Mirnograd, its sister city, and a large field set of forest belts underneath that in the south part that are completely surrounded now. No hope of getting out, and yet they won't. They didn't get them out when they had a chance to protect their troops, and now it looks like they're going to just have to fight until they die, or they surrender, or they run out of food, weapons, and ammunition, etc. And then, as you point out, there's the issue in Kupiansk, where a considerable portion, more than 50%, is already captured. There is effectively an operational encirclement. They have fire control over the routes that are leading into that. And then you have other issues down in the Zaporizhia area. You have fights going on in several other areas in between those, really all across the front there, even in the Kharkiv Oblast. There is now additional Russian penetrations into that area as well, because Ukraine simply doesn't have the manpower to fight all of them. So they had been trying to move some forces around to plug holes here, but they ran out of those. They don't have any more forces to plug holes, so the Russians just continue to move forward, and the Ukrainians continue to die every side. But simultaneous with this, you have the leadership of Kiev, you have the leadership in Brussels, and in unfortunately London and Rome and also Germany, etc., France, of course. All they keep talking about is, yep, we're going to keep going more. We're going to get another round of sanctions. We're looking on a 20th package. This is the most insane thing that I've heard of. 18 packages didn't work. 19 packages didn't work. Trump's putting his sanctions on some of the Russian oil firms. That didn't work. And now you want to get a 20. You just keep saying, well, whatever hasn't worked, we're just going to try it again. Even all the time this is happening, you have Ukraine men dying by the large numbers every day, cities now falling, countryside being just shredded and turned to rubble, etc., even in some of these smaller villages. And I'm like, do you guys not have any kind of morality at all to when you can graphically see with your own eyes? And now in the air, you see overnight, again, massive bombardment from the Ukraine side. Even Kiev, the whole city was knocked out for a period of time. And the damage done to others in Kharkiv City as well continues to make it almost unsustainable for the winter. And they're still not done. And with all of that, instead of making the rational, logical, moral choice to stop fighting a war that can't be won and now cannot even be prevented to be lost, they just keep on going on with this language of victory as though none of those things I've described are happening. And I consider that to be immoral, not just policy failures, but that's where we are.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit like in the fall of Baghdad when keep calm, carry on. There are no Americans here. While the Americans were in the camera shot, coming with their tanks up the
Baghdad Bob,
up the road. Yeah, I mean, that's what we've got now, and that's what our media now is, a chorus of Baghdad Bobs. It would be funny if it wasn't so tragic and so bloodily tragic. I mean, there's 10,500 men captured in this Dmitrov, in the Dmitrov Kessel. 10,500 men, or however many of those are left, and they're not being permitted to surrender. It's a bit like Hitler and von Paulus in the original Kessel around Stalingrad.
Yeah.
What can you say about political leaders that sacrifice their men on such a scale?
Well, I mean, all you can say is that at this point, it's hard to come up with any other answer other than it's cash. It's just money or arrogance and the presumption that I can never acknowledge reality, because then I would have to acknowledge that everything I've been saying for nearly 4 years has been roundly wrong. That's why you see this, well, let's try another round of sanctions, because just a little bit more, that will finally do what the previous 19 rounds wouldn't work. Of course, it's absurd on the surface of it, on the face of it. Everything going from 2022 to the disaster of the offensive in 2023, the failure throughout the entire calendar year of 2024 to stop the Russians, and now in 2025, you can't even keep the lights on in the city, and you're going back, and you're about to lose two pretty major cities along with that, and you're putting the rest of it at risk. And there's just not enough Ukrainian troops to fill the gap. Desertions are a huge portion. There's almost as many desertions as there are casualties, and there is not a fraction of enough people you force into uniform to come in to offset those losses. It's a mathematical certainty that at some point the Ukraine side will just simply cease to exist, and then the Russians are probably going to be free to literally drive into Ukraine because there won't be enough. At some point, that is likely to happen, because on the Russian side, they're increasing their production. They're increasing the number of troops that they have in active duty, meaning that they bring in more every month than they lose in casualties, probably by a pretty substantial number. It's grown up to around 1.5 million active now, 500,000 higher than it was when they invaded, even with all the losses that they've had. So any rational view would tell you that it would be suicide to continue doing this, to continue supporting this war. But I mean, there is big voices in the United States, the United States Senate, in our media. Certainly, there's those. It's amazing to me, George, where I'll see these videos coming from several well-known British outlets almost on a daily basis, talking about how Russia's not winning, Ukraine is on the way back. They're stiffening up, and soon they're going to turn the tables. I mean, every week, while the actual report on the battlefield is the virtual opposite. So all I can imagine is that it's either this inability to acknowledge reality, and there's just some sort of psychological problem, or they are aware of it, and they're like, but the money keeps flowing, so works for me. One of those two, but I can't think of a third one.
No, nor I. And of course, something's got to give. Either the military situation will collapse, and you'd be foolish to bet against that. However bravely the Ukrainian forces have fought for nearly 4 years, far more bravely than I expected them to, given the quality of their leadership and the conscript nature of their army and the forced conscription of so many people. They have fought valiantly, no one can doubt that. But if there's money,
absolutely,
it's not going to them. It's going to the people in the center, in Kiev. They're the ones that are making off with the millions, maybe tens of millions, maybe more than
listen,
that.
Listen, George, I just talked earlier the ones today I just talked to somebody in Kiev that has connections directly in Kiev that used to be in the Zelensky administration that drove that point home to me just a few hours ago, talking about how they're having to cut the pay of teachers, which was already minuscule, that the troops have now twice had their salary cut because there just isn't cash to go around. And then these monies that do come from fortifications and stuff get scraped off the top so much that hardly hardly any actually gets built. And then now then they don't even have money to pay for their government unless they get billions of dollars from Europe. And it used to be the United States, but now apparently it's just Europe. They won't even be able to keep the lights turned on or anyone paid. And of course, with no functioning economy, they may run out of money and the ability to keep the country physically operating before the troops even collapse on the front line. So where is all this money going? Because it sure is going somewhere.
Well, I think we can both take an educated guess as to where it's going and where it's currently resting in the accounts that we could name probably quite easily, and we'd probably come up with the same list. The other thing that can give is the political class themselves. They could say, well, actually, we'll need a new leadership to bring this to an end. We'll have to force somehow the resignation of Zelensky and his replacement with someone with a mandate to bring about peace. Because if neither of these two things give, the front is going to move and move. It'll move right up to the river, Dnipro. It will definitely move towards the liberation of Odessa. It will landlock Ukraine. It will rescue Transnistria. And then Ukraine will be a rump NATO stan that will be a burden to all of us for 100 years.
Yeah, and it's really already that's already baked in. In my view, even the Russia won't stop unless there's some kind of a deal that says there will be no NATO, no military support at all, and a reduced amount of troops for Ukraine. A demilitarization, they call it. The denazification is what you described there with the requirement for new elections or something. And those have to have, in addition, you know, some protections for the Russian ethnic Russians that will remain inside of whatever left of Rump, etc. Those things are already baked in, and then you're going to have this massive, massive amount of territory that's going to have to be rebuilt. Russia is almost certainly going to rebuild the areas where they have, and right now they've already, you know, written that into the Russian Federation, so in their mind already, it's already Russian territory. And we've seen, by the way, what they have done with the areas where they have already taken in the first couple of years of the war, and some of the rebuilding has just been phenomenal. It doesn't get any coverage in the Western press that I've seen, but if you look on their press, they've videos and stuff that they put up, it's been pretty remarkable how they've already rebuilt a lot of the war damage. I don't know who's going to be doing it on whatever's left of the Western side here. That remains to be seen, but I can assure you that whoever is left in Ukraine will be asking for lots of money for a long time into the future.
It'll be us, Lieutenant Colonel. It won't be you. It'll be us. The Europeans have been completely mugged. I mean, I was in Moscow until a couple of days ago, and it's full of Americans. The Americans are in every hotel. They're at every reception. They're in the Bolshoi. Trump Americans, prominent Trumpers, are all in Moscow, preparing for the day when normalcy will return. And they're in prime position to make sure that it's America and Russia that do the business and extract the minerals and the rare earths and all the rest. It certainly won't be Europe, whose economy, I don't want to exaggerate it to you, sir, but our economies are on the slide and our societies with it. So it'll be us. I'll answer your question. It'll be us in Europe that pays for it.
And it's ironic and also quite depressing that it wouldn't have had to be that way, because especially early in the war, there was a complete willingness on the Russian side, maybe you can speak to this even more than I could, that they were willing to say, let's get this war over with. Let's get this ugly pet chapter put behind us, and let's get a security architecture for the entire continent, for everybody in Europe and Russia, and all of us can work together and figure out something that's going to work to keep the idea and the possibility of war off the table, and people can live in prosperity together where they can be mutually beneficial in both directions. I maybe that would still be possible, but in my view, the primary Ukraine or European leaders, and that's multiple countries, have just absolutely cut their own wrist on this for the future by making, at least Trump is saying, I'm looking forward to the after the war portion, and we want to get back. He's saying that out loud. And so that apparently is why you've seen some of the Americans over there. They're looking forward to that. And I think the Russians are willing to do that. But then that's going to leave Europe on the outside of the opportunity. But we're hanging on to all of the bills to try to pay for all the rebuilding for the Ukraine side. So that seems like a pretty self-defeating policy for the Ukraine side. I don't get it. Or for the European side.
It's the biggest boomerang in history. Your friend and mine, Professor Glenn Deason, put it brilliantly today. He said, we could spend hundreds of billions preparing for war, or we could pick up the phone and phone Moscow and agree a common European security architecture, which guarantees Absolutely. The security of all of us. For the cost of a phone call, or we could commit ourselves, as Britain has, to 100 years of subsidy of a state which by then will be little more than a Kosovo.
And you know, unfortunately, oftentimes when you prepare for war, you get this opportunity, this situation to where you actually get the war that you're trying to stop. And listen, we're kind of guilty of that on this side, too. There was a speech on last Friday by Secretary of War, now poorly named, Pete Hegseth, said, hey, this is our 1939 moment. We need to start building up big time. We need our defense industrial base to start cranking into high gear, et cetera, as though we're in a world war, which is alarming enough to me. And, of course, Europe is in this, you know, with Mark Rutte, is in this big rearm Europe situation that's, you know, $800 billion through 2030 or whatever it is, to be even beyond that. Everybody jump up to 5%. I mean, what does anybody think that the Russians are going to do when you see all of this military buildup? They're not going to sit passive. They're not just going to just take Ukraine. They're going to start building up their own capacity and continue to build it up. And by the way, militarily and defense industrial base, they're way ahead of us. It's going to take us a long, long time and a huge amounts of money, way more than $100 billion, to even start to close the gap. And it doesn't need to be. We don't need to get ready for a war with Russia. We need to start rebuilding our economies and taking care of our people, which is something we can afford and something we can do. And then we have some security, because Professor Deason is 100% right. There is the possibility that we could have a continental-wide security architecture. It's not fantasy. But to get there, to even have a possibility, you've got to get out of this perverted mindset that we have with Mark Rutte, with our current Secretary of War, that all they're looking for is to have war capabilities. No one's even talking about putting money in the diplomatic realm. Let's see if we can find a way to get this stuff tamped down. That doesn't even happen, George, and that's one of the things that's alarming to me, because it could end up setting the stage for our own doom.